partway down the table here is Cynthia Barnett. She is a senior writer for Florida Trend Magazine. She wrote a book called Mirage, Florida and the Vanishing Water of the Eastern United States, which was described by one reviewer as part investigative journalism, part environmental history, which is like my favorite thing. In there, she lays out some of the problems that we have with water scarcity. She has just published her second book, which is called Blue Revolution, Unmaking America's Water Crisis. And I've dipped into that book, have not finished it yet, but I will tell you that to do this, Cynthia, I guess you went to the Netherlands and to Singapore and Australia. And the basic thrust of that book is that America needs, as Aldo Leopold, as we all learned about in Wisconsin, instilled a land ethic in Americans. She believes that it's time to instill a water ethic, too. So, Cynthia, what possessed you to write this book called Mirage when you live in Gainesville in this sort of, in this theoretically water-rich part of Florida where really, really beautiful water comes bubbling up from North Florida Springs in quite large quantities every day? What made you want to go out and do this?
Am I not? Sorry. Many of them have dried up. I think, about half dozen of these amazing springs have dried up, and so it's much of it is related to groundwater withdrawal. So, you know, the idea that people watering their lawns in Jacksonville and agricultural irrigation in southern Georgia is really dropping the levels of these springs. So that's just a little bit about what's happening in North Florida. But anyway, to answer Robert's question, how did I come to write a book about water scarcity when I live in one of the wettest states in the nation? I got really interested in environmental history, which Robert is also interested in. I decided to go back to school and get a master's degree in environmental history. And I was working on my master's in environmental history and reading all these great books, a lot of the national books, but also some books about Florida, this one in particular by a guy named Nelson Manfred Blake, who wrote a book called Land Into Water, Water Into Land. And he wrote, it's basically the story of how developers got rid of water, got rid of water, got rid of water. So I was working on that in graduate school, and then in my day job, I'm working as a business journalist, writing stories about how developers are desperate to find water, find water, find water. And so it was that specific irony that the same guys who got rid of it all then became desperate to find it. That's really what led me to this book. And Craig actually doesn't know this, but he has a part in this story. In 2003, when I was thinking about what to do next, I had written my master's thesis, and I thought, what should I do with this? Craig had a 1A story in the St. Pete Times called North Has It, South Wants It. And it was about this secret plan. These muckety-mucks had been meeting secretly for about a year or two, and one of the plans they were talking about was a plan to move water from the north, where I live, from the Suwannee River and these springs that I told you about that are drying up. They wanted to move water from the north to South Florida or Central Florida to, you know, quench that they had drained, what they had drained. And I think that single story got me so insane that I went on to spend the next, what is it now, the next 8 years of my life writing water books. So thank you, Craig. Did I answer your question,
you did.
Robert?
Moving along. Okay, so just as a general matter, does the lack of water make Florida, and particularly South Florida, unsustainable, and in what time frame?
Well, I don't think there's a time frame because I think it's unsustainable now. So, I spent Thursday with the Miami-Dade Water and Sewer Department, and their problem is not even so much getting fresh water as it is getting rid of the sewage generated by 7 million people living on this fragile tip. And so this sewage is being dumped right into the ocean. And so I would say the answer is that it's not sustainable now, but I feel hopeful, and my books, both books have this pattern where the first half is very muckraky and the second half I try to build hope for the future. And I think Perth is a, what? Oh yeah, is that, people don't want to read a depressing ending. That's right. So when I wrote about Perth in the new book, this sort of really interesting turning point happened in Perth, where one of their nationally beloved scientists, I don't know if we have any beloved scientists right now, but in Perth there, yeah, in Perth there was this beloved scientist, and he had been named Australian of the Year, and he had made this really dramatic statement that Perth would be the first ghost metropolis of the 21st century, that their water crisis would mean that Perth would actually, you know, cease to exist and everyone would have to move. And it was almost like when people heard this guy say that, and this was when the big drought had been going on quite a while, they really began to live completely differently. And they were a lot like Florida. The place even looks like Florida, full of palm trees, that looks a lot like this. And so I do have hope that Floridians too will learn how to live differently.
I'd like for you to tell, and I'm going to ask each of you guys to do this, because you're all hard-working journalists in your day jobs, and I think you're all recidivist authors, right? I think so. Michael's working on that. Everybody else has written at least two books. So how do you fit this into your job? How do you do this?
Oh boy, this is really hard. This is a hard question. The hard part for me is not so much the day job and the book author life, it's the day job, book author life, and motherhood, because I have small kids at home. So it has been unsustainable for me. So ever when I earned my master's degree, my son was an infant, and I've never gotten it right yet with the books and the day job and the kids. And so 2 weeks ago, I quit my very wonderful day job that I've had for 14 years.
Wow. Oh, I didn't know that.
I know.
Well, that's one solution, I suppose.
It's not only the balance, but you know, having written these two water books, and I have a third book in mind, and I just think about it all the time. And I really think that's what it takes to write a book. It takes becoming completely obsessed. And I've become so obsessed with water that I think about it all day. I dream about it at night, and I have this new book I want to write. And yet, in my day job, I'm writing business stories. So I'm going to try to write a third water book. So I will be totally broke, and I may not be at any of your future conferences.
Okay, well, thank you very much. There's other things I'd like to ask you. We'll get to them if we have time. Let's move on. Next, we have Mike Grunewald right here, Michael Grunewald, who got really interested in South Florida about the time that I left, I think. And did some wonderful reporting for the Washington Post on the Everglades restoration project, and I grew up here, and I wrote a lot about the Everglades, and it means a lot to me, and I felt like a little bit like of a rat moving out to Seattle and leaving it behind, but I found out in a matter of a year or two that it was in very good hands, and anyway, so that's when I first knew Michael's work, and it was great, and he went on to write one of my favorite books, really, The Swamp, The Everglades, Florida, and the Politics of Paradise. A wonderful book if you want to know about the history of the Everglades and also to know what's happened in recent years. Michael, tell us what possessed you to do this book?
This is another sort of roundabout story. I was at the Washington Post. I was not an outdoors guy. My idea of the outdoors, as I said on the Swamps blog the other day, I was playing tennis. I had I had really almost never been to Florida. I got obsessed with the Army Corps of Engineers, not because I was really an environmental reporter. I kind of stumbled into the way they were cooking the books of their economic studies to justify these kind of preposterous make-work projects that were supposedly these big economic drivers, but were actually, usually just economic drivers for the sponsors of the project. And then, oh, by the way, these projects were also destroying rivers and wetlands, and that was sort of a side issue. I ended up becoming this incredible core bore. I must have written, 100 stories in 2000. And the last one, I found out I did this big series, and at the end, there was supposed to be, what was the marketing? You want to end with the good news story. So I figured a nice story at the end would be, the Army Corps helped destroy the Everglades, and now they're in charge of the largest environmental project in history to try to restore the Everglades. They're kind of fixing their old mistakes. That's neat. That's kind of a potential future for the Corps. And I remember I left it to the end. My series was supposed to run the first week in September, so it didn't get into the election, in the whole election mess. And I first came down to the Everglades in August. I was like, why the hell does anybody want to restore this place? It is just, it's like muggy and nasty and disgusting. And the scientists who started taking me around were like, I was sort of like, so tell me about this wonderful restoration project. They're like, it's not even a restoration project. I was like, oh man, this is supposed to be the good news story. So the long story short is I ended up getting obsessed with this restoration project as well, and I wrote my series, and then when it was done, I was going to immediately launch into a series on the Everglades, but then September 11th happened and got distracted. But 2002, I went and did a whole series just about this restoration project and the various problems with it. Some of which, by the way, apparently they're going to announce next week they're trying to fix. So that's how I got into the Everglades. And then, I sort of sold this book that was going to be all about this restoration project. Of course, at the beginning, there would be a little bit about sort of how we got to this place where it needed to be restored. And I went down to Florida and I started getting into the archives. I was like, wow, this is just an amazing story. The kind of, Florida basically used to be a swamp. The story of how, not just this, restoration project with 62 components and $8 billion, which is moving water from Water Conservation Area 3A to 3B. I mean, that was all really interesting. But, oh my God, Henry Flagler and, the Seminole Wars. And, I mean, this is just incredible stuff. Spessard Holland and Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. So it ended up being a slightly different book than I expected. But really ended up being the sort of story of Florida. And I came down here, met my wife, who's running around the grounds here somewhere with my now two children that we've been overpopulating Florida with. It ended up kind of changing my life too.
Good. A couple of things I just have to note about this book. There are some really great investigative stories that are buried in here. One of which is about a outfit called Azurix that wanted to buy up all the Everglades water and had secret meetings with the South Florida Water Management District and others, I think. It turns out that a guy that I used to cover, who used to be the director of that organization, was sort of behind all this. And fortunately, they didn't go through with it. There's some great, you got great material about what went on in the governor's mansion and how they, the postscript to all this is that it was a really good thing that Governor Jeb Bush didn't go along with that, because it turns out, a couple of months later, the parent company of that filed for bankruptcy, and the name of them was Enron. So anyway, there's some great stuff buried in here. Tell us what Al Gore told you of it, just briefly about, this is another one. And did you put those in newspaper stories, or did they?
Ended up in the newspaper, too. Al Gore, I did interview him about the Everglades a bit. He was really one of the driving forces behind the restoration project in a very good way. Right in 99, 2000, he got involved in this very sort of sideline controversy over this airport that a couple of very well-connected Florida people wanted to build at the old Homestead Air Force Base, right at the edge of Everglades National Park and Biscayne National Park. This was essentially going to be the kind of, this was the sort of for when Cuba opens up time. It was a very complicated and kind of skeevy little scheme they had going. And Clinton had kind of said, you know, back God knows when, he had sort of said, oh yeah, this is a great idea. You know, this economic development, we're gonna help bring this place back. But it turned out, you know, this was sort of before any of the environmental studies had been done. And Gore was in this very odd position in 2000 because they were doing the environmental studies and he couldn't really come out and say, like, you know, hey, this is a bad idea. Although Bruce Babbitt came out and said, this is a bad idea. But Gore, there was sort of, if he had come out, it would have, you know, there would have been some questions about the, you know, integrity of the study. And also, he didn't really want to piss off the various political players who were behind this. He thought that, you know, he thought he still had a chance of winning a lot of Cuban-American votes. He had this sense that Florida might be sort of important in 2000. I don't know, kind of a crazy idea. But anyway, the enviros really started beating up on him, like, come on, Gore, come out against this. Gore's like, you know, I'm Al Gore, I wrote this book about the environment, you know, you kind of know what you got with me. He wouldn't take a stand, but he's kind of doing everything he can to wink, wink, nudge, nudge, we're going to kill this thing. It's not good enough. The enviros start holding rallies for Ralph Nader. They start phone banking for Ralph Nader. Sort of long story short is Nader ends up getting, what was it, 10,000 votes? He got a lot of votes, but the general feeling was that enviros probably cost Gore like 10,000 votes, and he only lost by 537. So afterwards, when I interviewed Al Gore, and I said, so, you know, you'd worked so hard on the Everglades. I should say the postscript is that then they did kill the airport. Yeah. They did the right thing. But he said, hey, I said, you know, Mr. Vice President, you know, do you feel like the Everglades cost you the election? And he said, no, look, this was a very complicated election. And, you know, there were so many issues where he kind of trails off.
He says, the answer is in my lockbox.
He trails off and he goes, you know what? Maybe they did. That's how we got George Bush.
So you're working on your second book, which I believe is about stimulus spending, yes?
It's about the Recovery Act.
Recovery, yeah. Okay.
And called the New New Deal.
So advice for journalists who want to do this?
That's a timely question. What I would say is that books are great in the pluperfect. They're great to have written. They really suck to write. They're kind of like nuclear power plants. Except when they blow up, right? But you know, if you have a nuclear power plant, that's great. You know, it's providing very cheap electricity. It makes absolutely no sense to build a nuclear power plant. It's like the economics are preposterous. I feel like that's sort of the story of books, that you really can't justify it rationally. So the one thing I always say is, if you're gonna sort of give in to this hideous, awful experience and alienate your family and your friends and not shave and sit in your underwear for a very long period of time, you better be really passionate about the topic. 'Cause it's gonna suck, no matter what. But if you're passionate, then it'll suck a little bit less. As for me, the Everglades really did become a passion, and it was interesting. You know, it was not only about the Everglades, but I felt I was sort of telling a larger story about Florida and a larger story about the kind of about man and nature. And you know, when you do a book like, you know, do any book, you want to be thinking about big things. You know, now I'm sort of in the depths of this agony. You know, writing a book that's supposed to be, you know, it's about the Recovery Act, but it's also about Obama, and it's about whether the American political system is capable of, you know, behaving rationally. Right now, it just feels like hell, and every day I ask myself why I'm doing it. So I guess my advice is, be sure.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. Next, we're going to turn to David Helberg on the end. David was a foreign correspondent in war zones, among other things, before coming to his senses and coming back here. And I think your first book was War Against the Greens in 94. Is that right, David?
Correct.
Okay. And since then, he's written 50 Ways to Save the Ocean, Blue Frontier, Saving America's Living Seas, and Rescue Warriors, which is a book about the Coast Guard. All great. This is the latest one, which I've only just started to dip into. It's called Saved by the Sea, A Love Story with Fish. And it's an intensely personal book, so in that sense, I think it's very different from your other books. I'm going to ask David to read a little bit of this. In here, he recounts how he came to be fascinated by the sea, and he actually remembers the day that this happened. And I just want to point out that I know people around here think I'm kind of old, but I just want to say, David, that day in 1967, I was in first grade, buddy.
Oh, yeah.
Well, no, I'm...
Go ahead and read that passage.
I can't say I'm not old. it was February 14, 1967. I know Robert wants me to read these two paragraphs, so I think I'll actually read five others instead. basically, this was sort of, you know, I always hung out on the beach at Jones Beach, you know, harassed my mom to take me there, and grew up on by the dock on the North Shore of Long Island Sound. But it really was, you know, coming to Florida back then was one of those transformative moments. And, you know, it was December, you know, February 14, 67. We flew out to Miami and drove down to the Keys on the old two-lane, highway. And I remember looking out at that sort of jade and aquamarine ocean. It was the first experience of my life of feeling like you've come home to some place you've never been before. And we stopped at Santelli's, which was a dolphin, one of the first captive dolphin sites that had blown space out of the coral. And there were like all of 30 of us. And they said, anybody want to swim with the dolphin? So I stripped down to my jeans and got to swim with the movie flipper. And only years later did I discover that the CIA was also keeping its dolphins at his facility. And with various plans, including using a dolphin to assassinate Fidel Castro, and but all they actually did was attach listening devices to Soviet ships in Havana Harbor. And this is a story I picked up, and over the years, you know, you keep finding new stuff about the. I've gotten the Navy's Let Me Visit with their dolphins, their 70 dolphins and 26 sea lions at Point Loma in San Diego, and. Most recent update is discovering the Russians killed two U.S. dolphins in the harbors in Nicaragua in the 80s when we were planting mines there. But this was all, you know, part of this passion for the ocean that really started on that trip. And there it is, as I said, so we finally get down to Key West and, you know, visiting, like Hemingway's house with the six toad cats and all that. And finally get in the water. I said, as a young kid, I'd looked up at the stars and gotten pissed off, thinking I'd been born a generation too soon to explore other worlds. But that week in Key West, after we took a tour on a glass-bottom boat, I got hold of a mask and snorkel, went into the water on my own, swimming far off the seawall where I saw live rocks and vibrant colors, sea cucumbers, a queen conch, a small hammerhead, gliding through a shallow coral canyon amidst shoaling fish, and realized there's this whole other alien world right beyond the seawall. And later we ate lobster and key lime pie at the A&B Lobster House overlooking the Gulf. And on another night, my mother took us to Corral's restaurant, which had big sea turtles and pens. And she had the turtle soup and let me order a vodka. And when I swallowed too much and grimaced, she turned to my sister and said, does he make a face like that when he smokes pot? We were both shocked. I could have run off to sea right then, but there's a war dividing the nation. We had to get back home to New York, where Martin Luther King came and spoke at our high school. Said, sadly, since that first visit, the Florida Keys reef system has gone from 90% live coral cover to less than 10%. Devastated by water pollution runoff from South Florida, septic tank and cruise ship effluent, physical impacts from jet skis, boats, anchors, people, from human intensified climate change that's led to warmer seas, coral bleaching, ocean acidification, make it hard for corals and other shell-forming critters to put calcium carbonate, pull it out of the seawater around them, and build their shell homes and limestone legacies on which new generations of coral polyps can grow. On one of my last visits in 2005, my friends Craig and Devon Perlo, founders of the activist group Reef Relief, took me snorkeling out by East Dry Rock, 7 miles off Key West. once vibrant area was all dead coral rock with dozens of recently added concrete wheels, where people are attempting to seed and grow endangered elkhorn coral with some success. Still, the experiment looks like a small English garden planted in a clear-cut forest. One of the bumper stickers Reef Relief passes out reads, "If you're not outraged, you're not paying attention."
Right. Very nice. Very nice. David, this is a very different book from your other books. The others are very much straight ahead journalism, really. Tell us a little bit about this book. It's an intensely personal book. Why did you decide to write it?
I wrote an essay right after my sister died a few years ago, and it talked about the personal connections and also how the ocean offers not only adrenaline rushes and excitement and challenge but solace. And I'd lost another my life's love some years earlier, and we had a memorial for her on one of her favorite beaches in Marin, on the Marin Headlands. And that was sort of that realization that even when large pieces of your own soul have drifted away, there's still the ocean, you're still part of something larger, and that the ocean gives you that sensibility. So the essay was run in a Canadian publication and as part of a collection of essays for the 70th birthday of Canadian environmentalist.
David Suzuki.
Exactly, Suzuki. And then the Canadian editor said, we'd like it as a book, and then they decided they wouldn't like it, but St. Martin liked it, so I just finished the Coastie book for them. I'd just come back from, like Mike says, he first got to the Everglades in August, so I was had just returned from a trip with the Coast Guard to Kodiak in February, and got back and talked to my editor and said, let's do this. So, as he said, if you're going to be passionate, most of us are passionate about, something, and I didn't have to do a lot of research. I already knew the background on this story. Right. So, I used my aunt as my fact checker. And, I think that people, for whatever reason, people seem to like stories about people more than they do groupers. And personally, I've met a lot more charismatic groupers than some of the people I met, especially when I was living in D.C. I say, I think the ocean is 97% of life on Earth, and if you want dead spaces, go to the moon or D.C., But it's that thing that I wrote it, and when I first started writing it, it was like and when I 7 years ago when I sort of transitioned and set up an ocean group, it was like I felt like I was traumatized, and so was the ocean. Now I'm better, but the ocean's not. And so we.
Okay. Any advice for folks who want to take on this crazy task of writing a book?
Like Mike said, it's sort of, I was just involved in helping my neighborhood in Richmond, California, helping stop a mega casino on the last undeveloped headlands on the bay. And I sort of felt a bit of a hypocrite, I'm fighting gambling, and yet I'm, like writing books is like playing the lottery, the next one for sure. And so now I'm working on number 6 on California and the Sea, and about 2/3. But it also gives you excuses to do the things you want to do. I mean, that's why a lot of us got into journalism, honestly, where, the first reporting I did, I was curious, it wasn't going to be urban guerrilla warfare, I realized, and I was 20, and if I was going to experience it, I'd go off to Northern Ireland and see what it looked like. And, so next week I'll go out, hopefully, and tag some white sharks, because I've never done that, and, it gives you, I was just spent a few days on the Faroe Islands, was out with the Navy on their Prius warship, their hybrid warship, which is very impressive, though, at $1.5 billion per unit, I don't think you can really build a fleet. But anyway, I just think, you write because you have a compulsion to.
It sounds like you're saying that if you're going to be miserable, you might as well have some fun along the way, right? Next up is...
Addicts aren't miserable. It's I mean, people wouldn't be shooting up if there wasn't a pleasure element.
Oh, well, that's a great segue, actually. Because now we have Craig Pittman.
Wait a minute.
and here is the segue. He's written two other books, including this one, but he has one that's coming out soon, and I'm going to talk a little bit about your books, and then we'll get to you.
Okay.
But he has a book coming out. It's about orchids, and I asked Craig, since it's not out yet, he could send me his manuscript, and he said, that's like asking a grandmother if she has any pictures of her grandkids. So anyway, I rather than go into the manuscript, though, I'm going to read something from a story that Craig says inspired his forthcoming book. It's Dateline Sarasota. It says, each year, more than 160,000 people stroll through Marie Selby Botanical Gardens and are dazzled by its spectacular orchid collection, from showy catalias to delicate pamphylodilums. But the most important orchid in Selby Gardens history is not on display. It's the one that could wreck the place. He goes on to tell about the importation of this particular orchid. But along the way, here's the segue. He quotes from a 1939 book called The Orchid Hunters by a guy named Norman MacDonald. He said, and MacDonald wrote, when a man falls in love with orchids, he'll do anything to possess the one he wants. It's like chasing a green-eyed woman or taking cocaine. It's a sort of madness. We're going to talk about that book in a minute, but this book here is about, I wrote a lot about wetlands disappearing when I was down here, but Craig and a guy named Matt Wade at the St. Petersburg Times really did an amazing job of tracking down all of the wetlands that have been destroyed and showing that most of them, many of them, were that was illegal. And it was a really great piece of work. That's that book. Second book was Manatee Insanity?
Manatee Insanity, Inside the War Over Florida's Most Famous Endangered Species.
And then there's this orchid book you have coming out. So I guess I would ask you, why do you keep doing this?
The first book wasn't my idea. It was Matt and I wrote this series for the paper, which, by the way, was partly inspired by Michael's stories about the Corps of Engineers. So I guess in a degrees of separation, it's Michael to me to Cynthia. A professor I know called me up and said, wow, I really love your wetlands series. Have you thought about turning it into a book? And I said, no, I never have. You know, like all journalists that had a novel that I've been working on off and on, mostly off for, 20 years. And, type a chapter, throw it away. And so we met with some editors from the University Press of Florida and gave them a one-page summary of what we thought we could do with it. And they loved it and said, go for it. And it turned into a much bigger thing than I thought because sort of like Michael, I started getting into the whole history of wetlands protection in the United States and in Florida in particular because lots of the big cases came out of Florida. And it was just, there were some fascinating people and fascinating stories. So we ended up writing a sort of a mix of environmental history and investigative journalism with that one. And so turned it in, glad to have it over with, and the University Press folks said, so, what's next? So in covering environmental issues in Florida, the most divisive issue, it's sort of like the abortion issue if you're covering religion, is manatee protection because it just makes people crazy. On the one hand, you have people who are absolutely obsessed with manatees. They love them so much. One woman I talked to, she was out on a date one night and saw some manatees swimming around near a dock, and she left her date and waded into the water to be near the manatees. On the other hand, you have people who just go nuts over the efforts to protect them because they feel like it's blocking them out of the things that, yes, freedom. And their idea of what Florida's all about is getting in their boats and going out and, doing 40 miles an hour down the canal and feeling the wind through their hair, which, I'm told about. I don't really remember. And those folks, they had some interesting stories to tell as well. So it was, I had been noodling with the idea of doing a book on manatee issues and had actually written up a proposal and sent it to a friend's agent and it got nowhere. But I told the University Press folks about it and they went, oh, that's great. And so I started writing it, and I was glad I had saved all my notebooks because I was able to pull lots of details out of that. And if I could mention sort of a practical tip, it's easier now to write these books than it was when I started because of Google News Archive, which makes historical research so much easier. You can just go in there and dig up lots of articles from the past that you can find. For the Orchid book, one of the characters in there is a guy named Lee Moore who calls himself the Adventurer. Don't call him an orchid smuggler because he says, I never smuggled orchids. It's what I was smuggling under the orchids. I was looking up stuff about Lee Moore's father and found out some things he didn't know. His father had been involved in a classic Miami scandal back in the 50s. His dad had worked for the FAA and had steered lots of money to Miami International Airport, and in exchange they bought him an all-electric kitchen. And Lee did not know that story. And he did not know that's why the family moved from Washington, D.C. to Miami, because his dad then got a job at the Miami Airport. So, wow. That's a very roundabout answer. Does that answer your question?
Well, no, that's good. So briefly, though, the book about the orchid, it's about, tell them briefly about the orchid book.
It's about orchid smuggling. It's about a specific type of orchid that was discovered in Peru in 2002. A guy named Michael Kovac was down there visiting with Lee Moore and telling Lee, boy, I love the fact that you've got all of these species named after you. I love that. It's a form of immortality. And so Lee loaned him his car and told him where to go. And Kovac went up into the mountains and stopped at this roadside stand, and this woman brings out what was later described as the most spectacular orchid discovery of the past century. The bloom is as big as your hand. It's fuchsia purple. It's gorgeous. And he paid $3.60 for it. It was potted. Took it back and showed it to Lee Moore. And Lee said, holy cow, you've got the holy grail of orchids here. You need to take it to Selby Gardens in Sarasota and get him to name it after you. But don't bother trying to get a permit. You'll never get one. So he sticks it in his suitcase, waltzes through the Miami airport without declaring it, told him he had plants, that's all he said, and drives it to Sarasota, and the scientists, the taxonomists at Selby Gardens, get very excited when he shows it to them, and at his request, they named it after him. They rushed their identification into print in order to beat a hated rival of theirs who lived down the street. And once the publication came out and they were finished patting themselves in the back, all hell broke loose because the government of Peru filed a formal complaint with the U.S. government and said, we want our flower back and we want you to find out how these folks got this out of the country. And so a grand jury was impaneled. Armed federal wildlife officers showed up at Kovac's greenhouse with a search warrant. They showed up at Selby Gardens with a subpoena deuces tecum for all their documents. All these scientists wound up getting called in to testify in front of the grand jury. And it just became this huge deal. And in the meantime, a guy named George Norris, this cantankerous guy who writes everything in all caps. And that was kind of the one thing I got tired of, was reading George's stuff. But he was telling his customers, hey, I've got an inside line. I'm getting some of these new Phragmopedium cavaquii. I have a connection down in Peru. Because it turned out Norris and his connection in Peru had been smuggling orchids out of Peru for 5 years. So the feds got wind of it. They busted both of them at the Miami airport. It just kind of shows how people get so obsessed and so greedy. I mean, this thing was selling for $10,000 a plant before the feds cracked down. And it gave me a way to... I guess one of the things that I liked about writing Manatee Insanity is writing about how the natural world can make people do crazy things, and orchids are the fullest expression of that by far.
Good, yeah. Thanks. It's interesting that you're writing a novel. I don't know, there's a saying about that. I don't know who said it, but it's just this. Every journalist in America has a novel in him. And for most of us, that's right where it should stay.
That's true. My journalism teacher used to say, everyone has one novel in them, and some people write it several times.